The Knoxville Symphony Orchestra kicks off their 83rd season on Thursday, September the 20th and 21st at 7:30 at the Tennessee Theater, featuring music of Brahms and Rachmaninoff, and the guest performer will be pianist Joyce Young, who is outstanding. We talked with her and Aram Demirjian. Aram, what do you have planned for this kickoff, and how important is it to have that first opening night just go off flawlessly?
Well, it's always important to get off to a good start. I mean, it just energizes everybody, the orchestra, the audience, me. We're starting off the season with some hits, with some music that is easy to love, that is familiar, and, you know, there's, I think, hardly any piano concerto out there more popular than Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and with good reason. It's a phenomenal piece of music, and Joyce was somebody who I knew I wanted to have come and perform in Knoxville ever since I got the job. She's somebody I've worked with before. She's somebody that I love collaborating with, and she's an incredible interpreter of Rachmaninoff. So this, the stars kind of aligned for this program.
According to Ace Edwards, our afternoon concert host, he calls it Rock 2. Do people inside in the symphony world refer to it as Rock 2, or is that just him?
I think pianists and musicians definitely say Rock 2 or Rocky 2, Rocky 3.
Yeah.
And each one of them are very different. And I think number 2 is the most melodic of them all. It really has this nostalgic and very passionate melodies interwoven in ways that really makes our heart rejoice and cry and everything in between. And it just takes you on such a journey. I think Rachmaninoff is so clever in understanding how a human mind, human heart works to take us on that journey. And when that Rachmaninoff climax hits, it's an extraordinary current leading up to a glorious moment.
That's really, the Rachmaninoff climax really is a thing. I never thought about putting it in those terms, but it's like, yeah, every one of his concerti has these sort of similar parallel moments of emotional validation.
Yeah, it really builds to this moment, and if you've heard it many times, it doesn't matter because you're waiting for that build and that climax. I remember I heard it when I was a teenager, and I didn't know what it was. I just heard it on the radio, and I remember thinking, I feel exotic. I feel romantic. I feel like I'm doing something special instead of just sitting in a dorm room looking at a radio.
I was just telling Joyce before the rehearsal last night that Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto was like my moody adolescent years music that I listened to when I wanted to feel really emotional. And, I personally think that one of the reasons why this piece and another piece on the program, Brahms' First Symphony, are so popular, even to this day, is because there's a vulnerability in each of those pieces, the composer's vulnerability, which I think you can sense as you listen to it. For Brahms, it was the anxiety about writing a symphony after Beethoven, who was, he just revered and who was the greatest symphonist. And for Rachmaninoff, it was because he was in a quite deep depression and had a great deal of self-doubt in his career at this particular moment. He had just premiered his own first symphony. It had been panned by the critics, and he was, a little bit gun-shy in terms of his composition.
That's an interesting point, that so many composers go through that, and performers, they hit a wall sometimes and thinking this isn't going to work. Joyce, you've had a lot of success as a piano player, and you've won a lot of awards and made a lot of milestones, but was there ever a point when you were getting started in your early years where you thought, maybe I'm not good enough, or, oh, that was a, I blew that one?
That happens all the time to this day. I think it's rare that I come out of a concert saying, oh, that was really good, nothing to fix. I mean, maybe that has never happened. There's always some things that always show up that I didn't mean to do or could have gone a little bit better, a little bit more refined, or a little bit more emotionally intact. And I think it's those moments, how you react to it, that really makes all the difference. There are moments where I think more I practice, the worse I'm getting. And that's when I visit my teacher of more than 15 years. And she assures me when that moment hits, it's because your standards have gotten higher. It's because you're working so hard and splitting hairs more and more and more and expecting something greater each moment, and it's the rate that it's not showing up. It's not that you're actually getting worse. So those words are very encouraging. And there's so many challenging moments as a traveling musician. The circumstances always change. You have different relationships with each piece, and you have to remember at the end of the day or right before the concert, we are creating one beautiful moment at a time. And as soon as something bad happens, must discard it right away from our minds and wait for that next moment, because it could be overshadowed by feeling sorry for yourself or regretting what just happened. So always look into the future and truly in the moment.
That sounds like good advice just for living.
It's hard, though, because there are these voices in your head that will be very negative and keep reminding you of those bad things you didn't mean to do. And I think that's what all the performances leading up to this moment has taught me, that that has happened so many times that I made the mistake because I was stuck in the past. And so always be in the moment. And that's really the last thing I tell myself before the concert. Always anticipate for that next moment. Do not dwell in the past.
Do you have any pre-show rituals? You know, do you play something on your desk or knock on a piece of wood or listen to a certain little piece of music? Both of you, do you have any things that you do before every show?
I drink a 2,000% vitamin C about half hour before the concert. And that I'm not sure what that really does, but it's that that citrusy, powdery taste in my mouth that lets me know a concert is around the corner. I've been doing it for years. So it kind of wakes me up in a weird way. And I also, all my little obsessive compulsive little things show up before the concert, and where I put the music is very important. So I walk around backstage looking for that perfect place, and I say, on this table, no one put anything else surrounding it, because I found a perfect place with a perfect symmetry, and the music sleeps there as I walk on stage and perform from memory.
Although I guess you could say I have somewhat of a pre-concert pattern, which is, you know, there is mass chaos in my dressing room in about the half hour before the program as I hurriedly try to change into my tux and, you know, gel up my hair the exact perfect way, and then remind myself of which sponsors I'm supposed to be thanking before the concert, and then, you know, sort of generally making the people backstage a little bit nervous, sometimes intentionally. Just, you know, I have fun giving them a little bit of a hard time just to keep everybody loose backstage. And, you know, I'm I think odd among performers in that, because I've got so much else going on before a concert, just in terms of, you know, speaking to the audience, thanking people. And I guess also actually here in Knoxville, a pre-concert ritual is to go out into the lobby as people are arriving and greet people. That's something that I started doing in my first concert and have continued to do, because I just find that it's very nice to actually meet the people that you're performing for. And I think that it deepens their experience as well to meet the conductor, you know, as they walk in. And probably that's why everything is so condensed once I actually do get back into my dressing room. But I'm unusual in that, generally speaking, in that last half hour before the concert, I'm not really getting my mind in the music. You know, it's sort of that came before. That came when I was studying. That came in rehearsal. And in the way I kind of approach living in the moment, as Joyce was saying, is, well, you know, the rehearsing is done, and there's great opportunity in the performance to add on to what you did when you rehearse, but also the performance I find can be quite liberating because the performance is going to be what it is going to be. It's I find it liberating that you don't have the option to stop and fix. You make what the performance is the best that it could possibly be in that moment. And so, you know, backstage, I'm not really obsessing. And then everything kind of slows down when I get on stage. And that, and like, so I get back into the music on that walk from the stage door to the podium.
Joyce, you're the daughter of scientists. Did they inform you in your music development in any way? Because I know your aunt had maybe a larger influence of getting you the piano and getting you into music. But I'm curious how your parents got you into music through their backgrounds.
My parents never had formal music education growing up. But my mom started to play the cello around the time I started to learn the piano and violin, actually, at the age of 4. So we would go to a music school together, and I would take lessons with my aunt, so my mom's younger sister, and then she would go off and then take her cello lesson. So it was kind of like an activity we did together, and I knew we were both beginners, and it was just very neat experience in the beginning. I think throughout my childhood, my parents expected me to do very well at school, and piano was not really the thing that they said, that's what you're going to do for the rest of your life. You need to be the best pianist there is. But I had this option to, I don't know, become a scientist if I wished, and there was always an option there, which I think was important for me, that music was something I chose rather than something that was just pushed onto my life. And it really surprised them along the way when at age 9, they heard from a Juilliard faculty when we were visiting New York City from Korea on a small vacation that she needed to start teaching me right away if music was something serious, because she really thought I had a lot of music in me. And when my parents heard that, that was very surprising to them. And from that point on, I think they did everything in their power to get me the best education and best opportunities, and all the stars really lined up from that point on. And I ended up moving to New York City, or New York, Long Island, New York, when I was 11, and taking lessons from Juilliard. And my parents were in full support in the way that my mom got a sabbatical year at SUNY Stony Brook as a researching cancer scientist. And my dad lived in Korea. He supported us from Korea, thinking we'd return a year later, but they ended up living apart for 15 years because I started to travel and be part of a management, and my mom had to travel with me. So I really turned their dynamics upside down, and this kind of almost full support without knowing what the outcome might be. I think that is really the definition of parents just doing everything for the child. And I only realize that now as an adult, that what they did for me was just completely and just over the top extraordinary.
It must be incredibly gratifying to be able to go out and perform at all these venues across the world and thank them for, you know, getting you there.
Yes, one of the greatest moments was when I was, I think, 20 years old, and I was on the New York Philharmonic tour going to Asia, and I got to do their concert in Seoul. And so my parents went with me, and then I think they had about close to 1,000 people that they knew come to the concert hall. And there's this great picture of in the lobby with everybody that they invited. And it really does look like an absolutely massive wedding without a groom, where it's like every people that heard about me, I met as an infant, just everybody showed up. And that was like a big moment for them. I think that they, you know, they're like, I told you she plays the piano, you know, and it was very, very, hopefully lovely evening for them.
And you look like Kelsey Grammer as an infant. Is that not true?
That's what I keep telling people, because I was such a strange-looking baby. Babies are not supposed to look like Kelsey Grammer, but I'm also the biggest Frasier fan on the planet. So there's also that. That's something I watch on the road. I mean, I could probably mouth every word with you, but it's in a foreign city when everything's unfamiliar. I put on Frasier, and then it just seems like things are calming down a little bit. They're sort of my extended family in my mind, and puts me at ease. And it's been following me around for a couple of decades now.
I'm relieved to know that somebody else does that too. Not with Frasier for me, but it's like, yeah, you take this little, you know, this little group of TV friends with you on the road. For me, it's the West Wing.
Okay.
PianistJoyceYang.com is your website. And of course, you know, we're always looking at websites of artists here. This is my favorite one for a lot of reasons. It's because I started looking at your website just for research, but then I started enjoying myself on the website and following your story. You have this incredible timeline of pictures. And then you have all these other pictures that change from black and white into color and these wonderful clips of music. It's just a great website. So I don't know how involved you were with that website, but everyone would have a look at it.
Oh, thank you so much. We took a lot of time making that website, and we try to post new content on, and it's always a work in progress, but we had a lot of fun gathering interesting pictures and putting together a little section called Joyce's World, where sometimes I just post things that have nothing to do with music. Like, if you know, I think food is something that all musicians just talk about when we're not making music. It's basically music and food. Those are the two things that rule a musician's life. And I cook a lot. So, yeah, I sometimes introduce dishes that people might not come across and things like that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a wonderful site. Coming back to a Rachmaninoff or Rock 2, when you're preparing a piece like this, do you have any go-to recordings of this piece that you love? And also, I noticed you're playing some Philip Glass in an upcoming concert, Mad Rush, and things like that. Same with that. Do you have go-to piano players that you look to for interpretations?
I think for Rachmaninoff 2, last week I listened to Christian Zimmermann's recording and Leif Ove Andsnes. They're very different. And I think it's important to listen to more than one, because it really teaches you, you have to dig within to show the rendition that you believe in, not try to be someone else. But they're great inspiration, because it's so vivid, and they can really define what Rachmaninoff really wanted to say from different lights, and they could both be equally correct and so convincing. And for Rachmaninoff 3, I always listen to a Horowitz recording right before, a few days before the concert, because you're really... Rachmaninoff concerto, they're so difficult technically, and you, a few days before, when it's just each minute is ticking, you just feel like the whole score is crashing down on you. There's so many things to fix, and you don't know what to focus on, because it just seems like a mountain of notes, and you're trying to climb this Mount Everest. And when you hear Horowitz recording, you feel like each moment is really not about notes. It's what they really stand for. I mean, that's what I keep telling myself, and I know that, and I've been thinking that for 20 years, but listening to Horowitz recording, it just, that idea comes back so loud and clear. So I stop harassing myself about notes and really thinking about what is in there, what's the magic in there, what's the perfume and what's the electric current in there that I want people to hear, because a lot of it, he didn't need to write so many notes. It's what do I want people to really get out of this moment? So you start focusing very positively, I feel.
Joyce Young will perform with the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra Thursday and Friday, September 20th and 21st at 7:30 at the Tennessee Theater. Thanks so much to both of you for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you.